along, playing these strange, eerie chords, and then starts to play this one riff over and over again. And Kim just looks at him and doesn't say anything. The phone rings from inside, and Muriel calls out, waving her hands.
It's for you, Kim!
Kim walks back inside, and I'm about to ask Blair if she wants to go, but Spit, still smoking the joint, comes over with some surfer to Dimitri and says,
Heston has some great acid.
And the surfer with Spit looks at Blair and winks, and then she pats my ass and lights a cigarette.
Where's Kim?
Spit asks when he doesn't get an answer from Dimitri, who just stares into the pool, strumming the guitar. He then looks over at the four of us standing around him, and for a minute, it looks like he's going to say something. But he doesn't, just sighs and looks back at the water. This young actress comes in with some well-known producer, who I met once at one of Blair's father's parties. And they check out the scene and walk over to Kim, who's just gotten off the phone, and she tells them that her mother's in England with Milo. And the producer says that last he heard, she was in Hawaii. And then they mention that maybe Thomas Noguchi might be stopping by, and then the actress and the producer leave, and Kim walks over to where Blair and I have stood, and she tells us that it was Jeff on the phone.
What did he say?
Blair asks.
He's an asshole. He's down in Malibu with some surfer, some guy, and they're holed up in his house.
What did he want?
To wish me a happy new year.
Kim looks upset.
Well, that's nice.
Blair says, hopefully.
He said, have a happy new year, cunt,
she says, and lights a cigarette, the champagne bottle she holds by her side almost empty. She's about to cry or say something else when Spit comes over and says that Muriel locked herself in Kim's room, and so Kim and Spit and Blair and I walk inside, upstairs, down a hallway and over to Kim's door, and Kim tries to open it, but it's locked.
Muriel!
She calls out, knocking. No one answers. Spit pounds on the door, then kicks it.
Don't fuck the door up, Spit,
Kim says, and then yells out,
Muriel, come out!
I look over at Blair, and she looks worried.
Do you think she's all right?
I don't know,
Kim says.
What's she on? Spit wants to know.
Muriel?
Kim calls out again. Spit lights another joint, leans against the wall. The photographer comes by and takes pictures of us. The door opens slowly, and Muriel stands there and looks like she's been crying. She lets Spit, Kim, Blair, and the photographer and me into the room, and then she closes the door and locks it.
Are you all right?
Kim asks.
I'm fine,
she says, wiping her face. The room's dark except for a couple of candles in the corner, and Muriel sits down in the corner next to one of the candles, next to a spoon and a syringe and a little folded piece of paper with brownish powder on it and a piece of cotton. There's already some stuff in the spoon, and Muriel wads the piece of cotton up as small as possible and puts it in the spoon and sticks the needle into the cotton and then draws it into the syringe. Then she pulls up her sleeve, reaches for a belt in the darkness, finds it, and wraps it around her upper arm. I spot the needle tracks, look over at Blair, who's just staring at the arm.
What's going on here?
Kim asks.
Muriel, what are you doing?
Muriel doesn't say anything, just slaps her arm to find a vein, and I look at my vest, and it freaks me out to see that it does look like someone got stabbed or something. Muriel holds the syringe and Kim whispers,
Don't do it.
But her lips are trembling, and she looks excited, and I can make out the beginnings of a smile, and I get the feeling that she doesn't mean it. And as the needle sticks into Muriel's arm, Blair gets up and says,
I'm leaving,
and walks out of the room. Muriel closes her eyes, and the syringe slowly fills with blood. Spit says,
Oh man, this is wild.
The photographer takes a picture. My hands shake as I light a cigarette. Muriel begins to cry, and Kim strokes her head. But Muriel keeps crying and drooling all over, looking like she's laughing, really, and her lipstick smeared all over her lips and nose, and her mascara is running down her cheeks. At midnight, Spit tries to light some firecrackers, but only a couple go off. Kim hugs Dimitri, who doesn't seem to notice or care, and he drops his guitar by his side and stares off into the pool. And 11 or 12 of us stand out by the pool, and someone turns the music down so that we can hear the sounds of the city celebrating. But there's not a whole lot to hear, and I keep looking into the living room, where Muriel's lying on a couch, smoking a cigarette, sunglasses on, watching MTV. All we can hear are windows breaking up in the hills, and dogs beginning to howl, and a balloon bursts and Spit drops a champagne bottle, and the American flag that's hanging like a curtain over the fireplace moves in the hot breeze, and Kim gets up and lights another joint. Blair whispers Happy New Year to me, and then takes her shoes off and sticks her feet into the warm, lighted water. Fear never shows up, and the party ends early. And at home that night, sometime early that morning, I'm sitting in my room watching religious programs on cable TV because I'm tired of watching videos, and there are these two guys, priests, preachers maybe, on the screen, 40, maybe 45, wearing business suits and ties, pink-tinted sunglasses, talking about Led Zeppelin records, saying that if they're played backwards, they possess alarming passages about the devil. One of the guys stands up and breaks the record, snaps it in half, and says,
"And believe me, as God-fearing Christians, we will not allow this."
The man then begins to talk about how he's worried that it'll harm the young people.
"And the young are the future of this country," he screams,
and then breaks another record. "Julian wants to see you," Rip says over the phone.
"Me?"
"Yeah."
"Did he say what for?" I ask.
"No. He didn't have your number, and he wanted it, and so I gave it to him."
"He didn't have my number?"
"That's what he said."
"I don't think he's called me."
"Said he needed to talk to you. Listen, I don't like to relay phone messages, dude, so be grateful."
"Thanks."
"He said he'll be at the Chinese Theater today at 3:30. You could meet him there, I guess."
"What's he doing there?" I ask.
"What do you think?"
I decide to meet Julian. I drive over to the Chinese Theater on Hollywood Boulevard and stare at the footprints for a little while. Except for a young couple, not from L.A., taking pictures of the footprints and the suspicious-looking Oriental guy standing by the ticket booth, there's no one around. The tan blonde usher standing by the door says to me,
"Hey, I know you. 2 Decembers ago at a party in Santa Monica, right?"
"I don't think so," I tell him.
"Yeah, Kickers party, remember?"
I tell him I don't remember, and then ask him if the concession stand's open. The usher says yeah and lets me in, and I buy a Coke.
"The movie already began, though," the usher tells me.
"That's okay. I don't want to see the movie," I tell him.
The suspicious-looking Oriental guy keeps looking at his watch, finally leaves. I finish the Coke and wait until around 4. Julian doesn't show up. I drive to Trent's house, but Trent isn't there. And so I sit in his room and put a movie in the Betamax and call Blair and ask her if she wants to do something tonight. Go to a club or see a movie. And she says she would, and I start to draw on a piece of paper that's next to the phone, recopying phone numbers on it.
"Julian wants to see you," Blair tells me.
"Yeah, I heard. Did he say what for?"
"I don't know what he wants to see you about. He just said that he has to talk to you."
"Do you have his number?" I ask.
"No. They changed all the numbers at the house in Bel Air. I think he's probably at the house in Malibu. I'm not too sure, though. Does it matter? He probably doesn't want to see you that badly."
"Well," I begin, "maybe I'll stop by the house in Bel Air."
"Okay.
If you want to do anything tonight, call me, okay?" I tell her.
"Okay."
There's a long silence, and she says okay once more and hangs up. Julian's not at the house in Bel Air, but there's a note on the door saying that he might be at some house on King's Road.
Julian's not at the house on King's Road either, but some guy with braces and short platinum blonde hair and a bathing suit on lifting weights is in the backyard. He puts one of the weights down and lights a cigarette and asks me if I want a quaalude. I ask him where Julian is. There's a girl lying by the pool in a chaise longue, blonde, drunk, and she says in a really tired voice, Julian could be anywhere. Does he owe you money? The girl has brought a television outside and is watching some movie about cavemen. No, I tell her. Well, that's good. He promised to pay for a gram of coke I got him. She shakes her head. Nope, never did. She shakes her head again, slowly, her voice thick, a bottle of gin, half empty, by her side. The weightlifter with the braces on asks me if I want to buy a Temple of Doom bootleg cassette. I tell him no, and then ask him to tell Julian that I stopped by. The weightlifter nods his head like he doesn't understand, and the girl asks him if he got the backstage passes to the Missing Persons concert. He says, "Yeah, baby," and she jumps in the pool. Some caveman gets thrown off a cliff, and I split. On the way to my car, I bump into Julian. He's pale beneath the tan and doesn't look too great, and I get the feeling he's going to faint standing there, looking almost dead. But his mouth opens and he says, "Hi, Clay." "Hey, Julian. Want to get stoned?" "Not now." "I'm glad you came by. I heard you wanted to see me." "Yeah." "What did you want? What's going on?" Julian looks down and then up at me, squinting at the setting sun, and says, "Money." "What for?" I ask after a little while. He looks at the ground, touches the back of his neck, and says, "Hey, let's go to the Galleria, okay? Come on." I don't want to go to the Galleria, and I don't want to give Julian any money either. But it's a sunny afternoon, and I don't have too much else to do. And so I follow Julian into Sherman Oaks. We're sitting at a table at the Galleria. Julian's picking at a cheeseburger, not really eating it. He takes a napkin and wipes the ketchup off with it. I'm drinking a Coke. Julian says he needs some money, some cash. "What for?" I ask.
"Do you want some fries?"
"Could you kind of get to the point?"
"An abortion for someone."
He takes a bite out of the cheeseburger, and I take the napkin covered with ketchup and put it on the table behind ours.
"An abortion?"
"Yeah."
"For who?"
There's a long pause, and Julian says,
"Some girl."
"I would think so. But who?"
"She's living with some friends in Westwood. Look, can you let me borrow the money or not?"
I look down at the people walking around the first floor of the Galleria and wonder what would happen if I spilled a Coke over the side. "Yeah," I finally answer. "I guess."
"Wow, that's great," Julian says, relieved.
"Don't you have any money?" I ask. Julian looks at me quickly and says,
"Not now, but I will. And, oh, by then it'll be, like, too late, you know? And I don't want to have to sell the Porsche. I mean, that would be a bummer."
He takes a long pause, fingers the cheeseburger.
"Just for some abortion?"
He tries to laugh. I tell Julian that I really doubt he'd have to sell his Porsche to pay for an abortion. "What is it really for?" I ask him.
"What do you mean?" he says, getting really defensive. "It's for an abortion."
"Julian, that's a lot of money for an abortion."
"Well, the doctor's expensive,"
he says, slowly, lamely.
"She doesn't want to go to one of those clinics or anything. I don't know why, she just doesn't."
I sigh and sit back in my seat.
"I swear to God, Clay, it's for an abortion."
"Julian, come on.
I have credit cards and a checking account, but I think my parents put a freeze on it. All I need is some cash. Will you give me the money or not?"
"Yeah, Julian, I will.
but I just want you to tell me what it's for.
I told you.
We get up and begin to walk around. Two girls pass us and smile. Julian smiles back. We stop at some punk clothing store, and Julian picks up a pair of police boots and looks at them closely.
These are weird looking, he says. I like them.
He puts them down and then starts to bite his fingernails. He picks up a belt, a black leather one, and looks at it closely. And then I remember Julian in fifth grade playing soccer with me after school, and then him and Trent and me going to Magic Mountain the next day on Julian's 11th birthday.
Do you remember when we were in fifth grade? I ask him. In sports club, after school?
I can't remember, Julian says. He picks up another leather belt, puts it down, and then the two of us leave the Galleria. That afternoon, after Julian asked me for the money and told me to give it to him 2 days later at his house, I come home and the phone rings and it's Rip, and he asks me if I've gotten in touch with Julian. I tell him no, and Rip asks me if I need anything. I tell him I need a quarter ounce. He's silent for a long time and then says,
600.
I look over at the Elvis Costello poster and then out the window, and then I count to 60. Rip hasn't said anything by the time I've finished counting.
Okay?
I ask.
Rip says,
okay, tomorrow, maybe.
I get up and drive to a record store and walk down the aisles, look through the record bins, but I don't find anything I want that I don't already have. I pick up some of the new records and stare at the covers, and before I realize it, an hour has passed and it's almost dark outside. Spit walks into the record store and I almost walk over to him, say hi, ask about Kim, but I spot the track marks on his arm and I walk out of the store, wondering if Spit would remember me anyway. As I walk to my car, I see Alana and Kim and this blonde rockabilly guy named Benjamin coming toward me. It's too late for me to turn around, so I smile and walk up to them, and the four of us end up at some sushi bar in Studio City. At the sushi bar in Studio City, Alana doesn't say much. She keeps looking down at her Diet Coke and lighting cigarettes, and after a few drags, putting them out. When I ask her about Blair, she looks at me and says,
"Do you really want to know?"
And then smiles grimly and says,
"You sound like you really care."
I turn away from her, kind of freaked out, and talk to this Benjamin guy, who goes to Oakwood. It seems that his BMW was stolen, and he goes on about how he finds it really lucky that he found a new BMW 320i in the same off-green his father originally bought him. And he tells me, "I mean, I can't believe I found it, can you?"
"No, I can't," I tell him, glancing over at Alana.
Kim feeds Benjamin a piece of sushi, and then he takes a sip of sake he got with his fake ID and starts to talk about music. New wave, power pop, primitive muzak, it's all bullshit. Rockabilly is where it's at. And I don't mean those limp-wristed stray cats, I mean real rockabilly. I'm going to New York in April to check the rockabilly scene out. I'm not too sure if it's happening there. It might be happening in Baltimore.
"Yeah, Baltimore," I say.
"Yeah, I like rockabilly too," Kim says, wiping her hands. "But I'm still into the psychedelic furs, and I like that new Human League song."
Benjamin says, "The Human League are out. Over. Finished. You don't know what's going on, Kim."
Kim shrugs. I wonder where Dimitri is, if Jeff is still holed up with some surfer out in Malibu.
"No, I mean, you really don't," he goes on.
"I bet you don't even read the face. You've got to."
He lights a clove cigarette.
"You've got to."
"Why do you have to?" I ask.
Benjamin looks at me, runs his fingers over his pompadour, and says,
"Otherwise you'll get bored."
I say I guess so, then make plans with Kim to meet her later tonight at her house with Blair, and then I go home and out to dinner with my mother. When I get home from that, I take a long, cold shower and sit on the floor of the stall and let the water hit me full on. I drive over to Kim's house and find Blair sitting in Kim's room,
and she has this shopping bag from Jurgensen's over her head. And when I come in, her body gets all tense, and she turns around, startled, and she reaches over and turns down the stereo. Who is it? It's me, I tell her. Clay. She takes the bag off her head and smiles and tells me that she had the hiccups. There's a large dog at Blair's feet, and I lean down and stroke the dog's head. Kim comes out of the bathroom, takes a drag off the cigarette Blair was smoking, and then throws it on the floor. She turns the stereo back up, some Prince song. Jesus, Clay, you look like you're on acid or something, Blair says, lighting another cigarette. I just had dinner with my mother, I tell her. The dog puts the cigarette out with its paw and then eats it. Kim mentioned something about an old boyfriend who had a really bad trip once. He took acid and didn't come down for 6 weeks. His parents sent him to Switzerland. Kim turns to Blair, who's looking at the dog. The dog swallows the rest of the cigarette. Have I dressed down enough? Kim asks us. Blair nods and tells her to take the hat off. Should I? Kim asks me, unsure. Sure, why not? I sigh and sit on Kim's bed. Listen, it's early. Why don't we go to the movies? Kim says, looking in the mirror, taking the hat off. Blair gets up and says, That's a good idea. What's playing? The dog coughs and swallows again. We drive to Westwood. The movie Kim and Blair want to see starts at 10 and is about this group of young, pretty sorority girls who get their throats slit and are thrown into a pool. I don't watch a lot of the movie, just the gory parts. My eyes keep wandering off the screen and over to the two green exit signs that hang above the two doors in the back of the theater. The movie ends really suddenly, and Kim and Blair stay for the credits and recognize a lot of the names. On the way out, Blair and Kim spot Lene, and Blair grabs my arm and says, Oh, no. Turn around, turn around. Lene is here, Kim says with this urgent voice. Don't tell her we saw her on MV3 today. It's too late, Blair smiles. Hello, Lene. Lene is too tan and only wearing faded jeans and this totally revealing Hard Rock Cafe t-shirt, and she's with this really young blonde boy who's also too tan, and he's wearing sunglasses and shorts, and Lene shouts, Oh my God! Blair! Kimmy! Lene and Blair hug each other, and then Lene and Kim hug and pretend to kiss each other's cheek. This is Troy, Lene says, introducing the young guy. This is Clay, Blair says, putting her arm on my shoulder. Hi, Troy, I say. Hi, Clay, he says. We shake hands, both grips kind of limp and shaky, and the girls seem pleased. Oh, my God, Blair, Troy and I were on MV3 today. Did you watch it? Lene asks. No, says Blair, sounding disappointed, glancing at Kim for a moment. Did you? Lene asks Kim. Kim shakes her head. Well, I couldn't see myself. Actually, I thought I saw myself once, but I wasn't too sure. Did you see me, Troy? Troy shakes his head, checks his nails. Troy was on it, but they missed me, and I was dancing with Troy. Instead of getting me, they got some bally bitch dancing next to Troy. She pulls out a cigarette, looks for a lighter. Maybe they'll repeat it, and you can look more closely, Blair says, almost grinning. Oh, yeah, for sure, they'll repeat it, Kim agrees, grinning, looking Troy over. Really? Lene asks hopefully. I light her cigarette. They rerun everything, Blair says. Everything. We never get to Nowhere Club. Kim gets lost and forgets the address, and so we go instead to Barney's Beanery and sit there in silence, and Kim talks about her party and I shoot some pool. And when Blair orders a drink, the waitress asks for ID, and Blair shows her a fake one, and the waitress brings her a drink, and Blair gives it to Kim, who drinks it down fast and tells Blair to order another one. And the two of them talk about how bad Lene looked on MV3 today. Trent calls me the next night and tells me that he's feeling depressed, doesn't have any more coke, can't find Julian, having problems with some girl. We went to this party in the hills last night. Trent starts and then stops. Yeah? I ask, lying on my bed, staring at the TV. Well, I don't know. I think she's seeing someone else. He stops again. We just don't have it together. I'm bummed out.
There's another long pause.
Yeah? Bummed out?
I ask.
Let's go to a movie, Trent says.
It takes me a little while to say anything because there's a video on cable of buildings being blown up in slow motion and in black and white. On the way to the Beverly Center, Trent smokes a joint and mentions that this girl lives around the Beverly Center and that I look a little like her.
Great, I say. Girls are fucked. Especially this girl. She is so fucked up. On cocaine. On this drug called Preludin. On speed. Jesus.
Trent takes another drag, hands it to me, and then unrolls the window and stares at the sky. We park and then walk through the empty, bright Beverly Center. All the stores are closed, and as we walk up to the top floor, where the movies are playing, the whiteness of the floors and the ceilings and the walls is overpowering, and we walk quickly through the empty mall and don't see one other person until we get to the theaters. There are a couple of people milling around the ticket booth. We buy our tickets and walk down the hall to Theater 13, and Trent and I are the only persons in it, and we share another joint inside the small, hollow room. As we walk out of the theater, 90 minutes, maybe 2 hours later, some girl with pink hair and roller skates slung over her shoulders comes up to Trent.
Trent, like, oh my God, isn't this place a scream?
The girl squeals.
Hey, Ronette, what are you doing here?
Trent is completely stoned, fell asleep during the second half of the movie.
Like, hanging around?
Hey, Ronette, this is Clay. Clay, this is Ronette.
Hi, Clay,
she says, flirting.
Hey, you two, what flick did you see?
She opens a piece of bazooka and pops it into her mouth.
Number 13,
Trent says, groggy, eyes red and half closed.
What was it called?
Ronette asks.
I forget,
Trent says, and looks over at me.
I forgot, too, and so I just shrug.
Hey, Trenty, I need a ride. Did you drive here?
She asks.
No. Well, yeah. No, Clay did.
Oh, Clay, could you please give me a ride?
Sure.
Fab! Let me put these on and we'll go.
On the way through the mall, a security guard, sitting alone on a white bench, smoking a cigarette, tells Ronette that there's no roller skating in the Beverly Center.
Too much,
Ronette says, and rolls away. The security guard just sits there and takes another drag and watches us leave. Once in my car, Ronette tells us that she just finished singing vocals, actually background vocals, on Bandarasta's new album.
But I don't like Bandarasta. He's always calling me Halloween for some reason. I don't like to be called Halloween. I don't like it at all.
I don't ask who Bandarasta is. Instead, I ask her if she's a singer.
Oh, you could say. I'm a hairdresser, really. See, I got mono and dropped out of uni and just hung around. I paint, too. Oh, gosh, that reminds me, I left my art over at Devo's house. I think they want to use it in a video. Anyway...
She laughs and then stops and blows a bubble and snaps her gum.
What did you ask me? I forgot.
I notice that Trent's asleep and I jab him in the stomach.
I'm up, dude. I'm up.
He sits up and unrolls his window.
Clay?
Ronette says.
What did you ask me? I forgot.
What do you do? I ask, irritated, trying to stay awake.
Oh, I cut everybody's hair at Flip. Oh, turn the song up. I love this song. They're going to be at the Palace on Friday.
Trent, wake up, asshole, I say loudly over the music.
I'm up, dude. I'm up. Eyes are just tired.
Open them, I tell him. He opens them and looks around the car.
Hair looks good, he tells Ronette.
Did it myself. I had this dream, see, where I saw the whole world melt. I was standing on La Cienega, and from there I could see the whole world, and it was melting, and it was just so strong and realistic-like. And so I thought,
Well, if this dream comes true, how can I stop it, you know?
I'm nodding my head.
How can I change things, you know? So, I thought if I, like, pierced my ear or something, like, alter my physical image, dye my hair, the world wouldn't melt. So I dyed my hair, and this pink lasts. I like it. It lasts. I don't think the world is gonna melt anymore.
I'm not too reassured by her tone, and I can't believe I'm actually nodding my head, but I pull up to Danny's Okie Dog on Santa Monica, and she trips as she climbs out of the small back seat of the Mercedes and lies on the sidewalk and laughs as I drive away. I ask Trent where he met her. We pass the billboard on Sunset. Disappear here. Wonder if he's for sale.
Just around, he says. Want a joint?
Next day, I stop by Julian's house in Bel Air with the money in a green envelope. He's lying on his bed in a wet bathing suit watching MTV. It's dark in the room, the only light coming from the black and white images on the television. I brought the money, I tell him.
Great, he says.
I move over to his bed and put down the money.
You don't have to count it. It's all there.
Thanks, Clay.
What is it really for, Julian?
Julian watches the video until it's over and then turns away and says,
Why?
Because that's a lot of money.
Then why did you give it to me?
He asks, running his hand over his smooth, tan chest.
Because you're a friend?
It comes out sounding like a question. I look down.
Right,
Julian says, his eyes going back to the television. Another video flashes on. Julian falls asleep. I leave. Rip calls me up and tells me that we should meet at La Scala Boutique, have a little lunch, a little chopped salad, discuss a little business. I drive to La Scala and find a parking space in back and sit there and listen to the rest of a song on the radio. A couple behind me in a dark blue Jaguar think that I'm leaving, but I don't wave them on. I sit there a little longer, and the couple in the Jaguar finally honk their horn and drive off. I get out of the car and walk into the restaurant and sit at the bar and order a glass of red wine. After I finish it, I order a second, and by the time Rip arrives, I've had three glasses.
Hey, babe, how's it going?
I stare at the glass.
Did you bring it?
Hey, babe. The tone changes. I asked you how it's going. Are you gonna answer me, or like, what's the story?
I'm great, Rip. Just great.
That's terrific. That's all I wanted to hear. Finish the wine and we'll get a booth, okay?
Okay.
You look good.
Thanks, I say,
and finish the wine and leave a tan on the bar.
Great tan, he tells me as we sit down.
Did you bring it? I ask.
Cool down, Rip says, looking at the menu. It's getting hot.
Real hot. Like last summer.
Yeah.
An old woman, holding an umbrella, falls to her knees on the other side of the street.
Remember last summer? He's asking me.
Not really. There are people standing over the old woman, and an ambulance comes, but most of the people in La Scala don't seem to notice.
Yeah, sure you do.
Last summer. Things I remember about last summer. Hanging out at clubs, The Wire, Nowhere Club, Land's End, The Edge. An albino in canters around 3 in the morning. Huge green skull leering at drivers from a billboard on Sunset. Hooded, holding a pyx, bony fingers beckoning. Saw a transvestite wearing a halter top in line at some movie. Saw a lot of transvestites that summer. Dinner at Morton's with Blair when she told me not to go to New Hampshire. I saw a midget get into a Corvette. Went to a Go-Go's concert with Julian. Party at Kim's on a hot Sunday afternoon. B-52s on the stereo. Gazpacho, chili from Chazen's, hamburgers, banana daiquiris, double rainbow ice cream.
two English boys lounging by the pool who tell me about how much they like working at Fred Siegel. All the English boys I met that summer worked at Fred Siegel. Thin French boy, who Blair slept with, smoking a joint, feet in the jacuzzi. Big black Rottweiler bites at the water and swims laps. Rip carries a plastic eyeball in his mouth. I keep staring past the palm trees, watching the skies. Someone is supposed to be playing at the palace tonight, but Blair's drunk and Kim spots Lene hanging out in front, and the two of them groan, and Blair turns the car around. Someone named Angel was supposed to go with us tonight, but earlier today she got caught in the drain of her jacuzzi and almost drowned. Kim says that the garage reopened somewhere on La Brea, and Blair drives to La Brea and then down La Brea, and then up and then down once more, and she can't find it. Blair laughs and says, "This is ridiculous," and pushes in some Spandau Ballet tape and turns the volume up. "Let's just go to the fucking edge," Kim yells. Blair begins to laugh and then says, "Oh, all right. What do you think, Clay? Should we go to the edge?" Kim asks. I'm sitting in the back seat, drunk, and I shrug. And when we get to the edge, I drink two more drinks. The DJ at the edge tonight isn't wearing a shirt, and his nipples are pierced, and he wears a leather cowboy hat, and between songs he keeps mumbling, "Hip hip hooray." Kim tells me that the DJ obviously cannot decide whether he's butch or new wave. Blair introduces me to one of her friends, Christy, who's on this new TV show on ABC. Christy is with Lindsay, who's tall and looks a lot like Matt Dillon. Lindsay and I walk upstairs to the restroom and do some coke in one of the stalls. Above the sink, on the mirror, someone's written in big black letters, "Gloom Rules." After we leave the restroom, Lindsay and I sit at the bar upstairs, and he tells me that there's not too much going on anywhere in the city. I nod, watch the large strobe light blink off and on, flashing across the big dance floor. Lindsay lights my cigarette and begins to talk, but the music's loud and I can't hear a lot of what he's saying. Some surfer bumps into me and then smiles and asks for a light. Lindsay gives the boy a light and smiles back. Lindsay then begins to talk about how he hasn't met anyone for the past 4 months who's over 19. "Blows your mind away, huh?" he screams over the sound of the music. Lindsay gets up and says that he spots his dealer and has to go talk to her. I sit at the bar alone and light another cigarette, order another drink. There's a fat girl also sitting alone at the near empty bar, trying to talk to the bartender, who, like the DJ, is also shirtless and dancing by himself behind the bar to the music that's pouring out of the club's sound system. The fat girl has a lot of makeup on, and she's sipping a tab with a straw and wearing purple Calvin Klein jeans and matching cowboy boots. The bartender isn't listening to her, and I have this image of her, sitting alone in a room somewhere in the city, waiting for a phone to ring. The fat girl orders another tab. From downstairs, the music stops, and the DJ announces that there'll be a miniskirt beach party at the Florentine Gardens in 2 weeks. "It's really lively tonight," the fat girl tells the bartender.
"Where?"
the bartender asks. The girl looks down, embarrassed for a moment, and pays for her drink, and I can barely hear her mumble, "Somewhere." And she gets up and buttons the top button on her jeans and leaves the bar. And sometime, later that night, I realize I'm going to be home for 2 more weeks. The psychiatrist I see tells me that he has a new idea for a screenplay. Instead of listening, I sling a leg over the arm of the huge black leather chair in the posh office and light another cigarette, a clove. This guy goes on, and after every couple of sentences, he runs his fingers through his beard and looks at me. I have my sunglasses on, and he isn't too sure if I'm looking at him. I am. The psychiatrist talks some more, and soon it really doesn't matter what he says. He pauses and asks me if I would like to help him write it. I tell him that I'm not interested. The psychiatrist says something like,
"You know, Clay, that you and I have been talking about how you should become more active and not so passive, and I think it would be a good idea if you would help me write this. At least a treatment."
I mumble something, blow some of the clove smoke toward him, and look out the window. I park my car in front of Trent's new apartment, a few blocks from UCLA in Westwood, the apartment he lives in when he has classes. Rip answers the door, since he's now Trent's dealer, since Trent hasn't been able to find Julian.
Guess who's here? Rip asks me.
Who?
Guess.
Who?
Guess.
Tell me, Rip.
He's young, he's rich, he's available, he's Iranian.
Rip pushes me into the living room.
Here's Atif.
Atif, who I haven't seen since graduation, is sitting on the couch wearing Gucci loafers and an expensive Italian suit. He's a freshman at USC and drives a black 380 SL.
Ah, Clay, how are you, my friend?
Atif gets up from the couch and shakes my hand.
Okay, how about you?
Oh, very good, very good. I just got back from Rome.
Rip walks out of the living room and into Trent's room and turns MTV on and the sound up.
Where's Trent? I ask, wondering where the bar is.
In the shower,
Atif says.
You look great. How was New Hampshire?
It was okay, I say, and smile at Trent's roommate, Chris, who's sitting at the table in the kitchen, on the phone. He smiles back and gets up and starts pacing nervously around the kitchen. Atif is talking about clubs in Venice and how he lost a piece of Louis Vuitton luggage in Florence. He lights a thin Italian cigarette.
I got back 2 nights ago because I was told classes start soon. I'm not sure when they do, but I hear that it is rather soon.
He pauses.
Did you go to Sandra's party at Spago last night?
No,
it wasn't very good.
I'm nodding and looking over at Chris, who gets off the phone and yells,
Shit!
What is wrong? Asks Atif.
I had my guitar stolen and I had some disoxin hidden in it, and I was supposed to give it to someone.
What do you do? I ask Chris.
Hang around UCLA.
Enrolled in classes?
I think.
He also writes music, says Trent, standing in the doorway. Only wearing jeans, hair wet, toweling it dry.
Play them some of your stuff.
Sure, Chris says, shrugging. Chris goes to the stereo and puts a tape in it. From where I'm standing, I can see the jacuzzi, steaming, blue, lit, and past that, a weight set and 2 bicycles. I sit down on the couch and look through some of the magazines spread across the table, a couple of GQs and a few Rolling Stones, and an issue of Playboy, and the issue of People with a picture of Blair and her father in it, and a copy of Stereo Review and Surfer. Flip through a Playboy, then start to space out and stare at the framed poster for the Hotel California album, at the hypnotizing blue lettering, at the shadow of the palms. Trent mentions that someone named Larry didn't get into film school. The music comes out over the speakers, and I try to listen to it, but Trent's still talking about Larry, and Rip is cracking up hysterically in Trent's room.
I mean, his father's got a fucking series that's in the fucking top 10. He's got his own Steadicam, and USC still doesn't let him in? Things are fucked up.
They didn't let him in because he's a heroin addict, Rip calls out.
What bullshit, Trent says.
You didn't know that?
Rip laughs.
What in the hell are you talking about?
He practically eats it raw,
Rip says, turning the volume on the television down.
He used to be normal.
Oh shit, Rip, I call out. What does normal mean to you?
No, I mean really normal.
Shit, I never knew that about Larry, Atif says.
You're so full of shit,
Trent calls out to the bedroom.
Aw, Trent, suck my dick,
Rip yells.
Take it out,
Trent calls out, laughing, walking back to the bedroom.
Hey, who made the reservations at Morton's?
Deja vu passes through me, and I open a GQ. Faces from my sister's walls come back to me. The music is loud, and the songs sound like they're being sung by a little girl, and the drum machine is too noisy and insistent. The little girl voices sing out, I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do.
I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. Tell me. Tell me.
Did you make the reservations? Trent calls again.
You have any meth?
Chris calls back to Trent.
No.
Trent calls back.
Who made the reservations?
Yes, I made them.
Rip shouts.
Now shut up.
Do any of you guys have any meth?
Chris asks.
Meth?
Atif asks.
Look, we don't have any meth,
I tell him. The music stops.
You gotta hear this next song, Trent says, pulling on a shirt.
Chris ignores him and picks up the phone in the kitchen. He dials and then asks whoever's on the other end if they have any meth. Chris pauses and hangs up, looking dejected.
Some guy propositioned me today,
Rip is saying, walking into the living room.
He just came up to me in Flip and offered me $600 to go to Laguna with him for the weekend.
I'm sure you're not the only guy he approached, Trent says, coming out into the living room and opening the door that leads out to the jacuzzi. He bends down and feels the water.
Chris, do you have any cigarettes?
Yeah, in my room on the bedstand, Chris says, dialing another number.
I stare back at the poster and wonder if I should do the coke I have in my pocket now, before we go to Morton's, or when we get there. Trent comes out of Chris's room and wants to know who's lying on the floor of Chris's room, sleeping.
Oh, that's Alan, I think. He's been there for like 2 days.
Oh, that's great, Trent says. Just great.
Just leave him alone. He has mono or something.
Let's just go, Trent says. Rip goes to the bathroom first, and Atif and I stand up. Chris hangs up the phone.
Are you going to be here when I get back? Trent asks him.
No, gotta go over to the colony, look for some meth.
My dreams start out calmly. I'll be younger and walking home from school, and the day will be overcast, clouds gray and white, and some of them purple. Then it'll start to rain, and I'll begin to run. After running through all this falling water for what seems to be a really long time, I'll suddenly trip into mud and fall flat on the ground. And because the earth's so wet, I start to sink. And the mud fills my mouth, and I start to swallow it. And then it goes up through my nose and finally into my eyes. And I don't wake up until I'm completely underground. It begins to rain in L.A. I read about the houses falling, slipping down the hills in the middle of the night, and I stay up all night, usually wired on coke, until early morning to make sure nothing happens to our house. Then I go out into the damp, humid morning and get the paper, read the film section, and try to ignore the rain. Nothing much happens during the days it rains. One of my sisters buys a fish and puts it in the jacuzzi, and the heat and chlorine kill it. I get these strange phone calls. Someone calls, usually late at night, and on my number, and when I answer the phone, the person on the other end doesn't say anything for 3 minutes. I keep count. Then I'll hear a sigh, and the person hangs up. The streetlights on Sunset get short-circuited, so a yellow light will be flashing at an intersection, and then a green one will blink on for a couple of seconds, followed by the yellow. And then the red and green lights will start to shine at the same time. I get a message that Trent stopped by. He was wearing a really expensive suit, my sisters said, and driving someone else's Mercedes.
Friend of mine's, Trent told them.
He also told them to tell me that Scott OD'd. I don't know who Scott is. It keeps raining. And that night, after I get 3 of the weird, silent phone calls, I break a glass by throwing it against the wall. No one comes in to see what the sound was. Then I lie on the bed, awake, take 20 milligrams of Valium to come off the coke, but it doesn't get me to sleep. I turn MTV off and the radio on. But Kanak won't come in, so I turn the radio off and stare out across the valley and look at the canvas of neon and fluorescent lights lying beneath the purple night sky. And I stand there, nude, by the window, watching the clouds pass. And then I lie on my bed and try to remember how many days I've been home. And then I get up and pace the room and light another cigarette,
and then the phone will ring. This is how the nights are when it rains. I'm sitting in Spago with Trent and Blair, and Trent says he's positive that there were people doing cocaine at the bar. And I tell him, why don't you go join them? And he tells me to shut up. Since we did half a gram before leaving Trent's apartment, none of us are too hungry. And we only order appetizers and one pizza, and keep drinking grapefruit juice and vodka. Blair keeps smelling her wrist and humming along with the new Human League single that's playing over the stereo system. Blair asks the waiter, after he brings us our fourth round of Greyhounds, if he was at the Edge the other night. He smiles and shakes his head.
So tell me, Blair asks Trent, is Walker really an alcoholic?
Yeah, Walker is, Trent says.
I knew it. But Walker's great, though. Walker's nice.
Trent laughs and agrees, then looks at me. I'm totally startled for a moment, and I look at both of them and say, Walker is nice. I don't know who Walker is.
Yeah, I like Walker, Trent says. Yeah, Walker's nice.
Blair nods.
Hey, did I tell you? Trent begins. I'm going to the Springs tomorrow. I have to go down and watch some dumbass Mexican gardener plant cactus in the backyard. Is that the most typical thing you have ever heard of? So typical. Mom asked me, and I said, no way, dude. And she said, you never do anything for me. And I mean, she was right, and so I said, okay, because I felt sorry for her, you know? Besides, I heard that Sandy has some great coke, and he'll be there.
Blair smiles.
You're such a nice boy.
It's getting to be toward midnight, and someone pays the check, and I tell Trent, after Blair's left for the restroom, that I didn't have the slightest idea who Walker is. Trent looks at me and says, you don't make any sense. You know that?
That makes sense. No, dude. You're ridiculous.
Why don't I make sense?
Because you just don't.
That doesn't make sense.
Maybe it doesn't.
Jesus. You're a fool, Clay. Trent laughs.
No, I'm not, I tell him, laughing back. Yeah, I think you are. In fact, I'm totally sure of it, he says. Are you?
Trent finishes his drink, sucks on an ice cube, and asks,
so, who are you fucking?
No one.
Who I fuck is not your business or Blair's, okay?
Yeah, right, he snorts. What is this? I ask Trent. He doesn't say anything.
Who are you fucking? I ask him.
Oh, come on, Clay, please.
No, who are you fucking, Trent?
I ask again.
You don't get it, do you?
Get what? What is there to get? I ask. If this has anything to do with Blair, you're really screwed. She should know better.
Does she think we're still going out? Is that what she told you?
Well, we're not, okay? Got it?
The coke's wearing off, and I'm about to get up and go to the men's room.
Have you told her? He finally asks.
No, I say, still looking at him, then out the window.
Tacky. Really tacky, he says slowly.
What's tacky?
Blair asks, sitting down.
Roberto, Trent says, averting his eyes from mine.
I don't want to leave Trent and Blair alone, so I sit there, very still.
Oh, I don't know. I think he's friendly.
No, he isn't.
He's just different,
Blair says.
Why do you like him?
Trent asks, finishing another ice cube, glaring at me.
Because, Blair says, standing up.
Because you don't spend that much time with him.
Trent gets up also, and Blair laughs and says, could be.
And she's in a better mood, and I start to wonder if she did any coke in the bathroom.
Probably.
And then I wonder if it makes any difference.
While waiting for the car to arrive, Blair and Trent smile at each other in this way that really irritates me. And then she looks up at the sky, which is cloudy, and it begins to rain lightly. We get into Blair's car, and she puts in a tape that she made the other night, and Bananarama starts to sing, and Trent asks her where the Beach Mix tape is, and Blair tells him that she burned it because she heard it too many times. For some reason, I believe this, and unroll the window, and we drive to After Hours. The girl I'm sitting next to at After Hours is 16 and tan, and tells me that it's tragic that K-Rock has a playlist. Blair is sitting across from me, and next to Trent, who's doing his Richard Blade impersonation for two young blonde girls. Rip comes over, after talking to the gay porno star who's sitting at the bar with his girlfriend, and he whispers something in Blair's ear, and the two of them get up and leave. The girl, who's sitting next to me, is drunk, and has her hand on my thigh, and is now asking if the whiskey burned down, and I tell her, yeah, sure. And Blair and Rip come back and sit down, and they both seem insanely alert. Blair's head moves back and forth quickly, staring at the dancers in the club, and Rip's eyes dart from side to side, looking for the girl he came with. Blair picks up a crayon and starts to write something on the table. Rip spots the girl. Tall blonde boy comes over to our table, and one of the girls sitting next to Trent jumps up and says, "Teddy, I thought you were in a coma." And Teddy explains that, no, he wasn't in a coma, but that he did get his driver's license revoked for drunk driving on Pacific Coast Highway. And Blair keeps drawing on the table, and Teddy sits down. I think I see Julian here, leaving, and I get up from the table and go to the bar, and then outside. And it's raining hard, and I can hear Duran Duran from inside, and a girl I don't know passes by and says, "Hi." And I nod and then go to the restroom and lock the door and stare at myself in the mirror. People knock on the door and I lean against it, don't do any of the coke, and cry for around 5 minutes. And then I leave and walk back into the club and it's dark and crowded and nobody can see that my face is all swollen and my eyes are red. And I sit down next to the drunken blonde girl and she and Blair are talking about SAT scores. Then Griffin comes in with this really beautiful blonde girl, and he flashes me a smile, and the two of them go to the bar to talk to the gay porno star and his girlfriend. And somewhere along the line, Blair leaves with Rip, or maybe with Trent. Or maybe Rip leaves with Trent, or maybe Rip leaves with the two blonde girls sitting next to Trent, or maybe Blair leaves with the two blonde girls. And I end up dancing with this girl, and she leans over to me and whispers that maybe we should go to her place. And we cross the crowded dance floor, and she goes to the restroom, and I wait at a table for her. Someone's written "Help Me" over and over in red crayon on the table in a childish scrawl. And there are little curly cues on the E's and me, and phone numbers written around the 20 "Help Me's," and a lot of unreadable writing around the telephone numbers, and the two red words stick out even more. The girl comes back, and we walk out of After Hours, past the girl who said hi to me, crying in the doorway, and the gay porno star smoking a joint in the alley, past the four Mexican guys teasing the kids who go in and out of the club, and past the security officer and the parking attendant who keeps telling the Mexican boys that they'd better leave. And one of them calls out to me, "Hey, punk faggot!" And the girl and I get into her car and drive off into the hills, and we go to her room and I take off my clothes and lie on her bed. And she goes into the bathroom, and I wait a couple of minutes and then she finally comes out, a towel wrapped around her, and sits on the bed, and I put my hands on her shoulders. And she says, "Stop it," and after I let go, she tells me to lean against the headboard, and I do. And then she takes off the towel and she's naked, and she reaches into the drawer by her bed and brings out a tube of Banda Soleil. And she hands it to me, and then she reaches into the drawer and brings out a pair of Wayfarer sunglasses, and she tells me to put them on, and I do. And she takes the tube of suntan lotion from me and squeezes some onto her fingers, and then touches herself, and motions for me to do the same, and I do. After a while, I stop, and reach over to her, and she stops me and says no, and then places my hand back on myself, and her hand begins again. And after this goes on for a while, I tell her that I'm going to come, and she tells me to hold on a minute, and that she's almost there, and she begins to move her hand faster, spreading her legs wider, leaning back against the pillows. And I take the sunglasses off, and she tells me to put them back on, and I put them back on. And it stings when I come, and then I guess she comes too. Bowie's on the stereo, and she gets up, flushed, and turns the stereo off, and turns on MTV. I lie there, naked, sunglasses still on, and she hands me a box of Kleenex. I wipe myself off and then look through a Vogue that's lying by the side of the bed. She puts a robe on and stares at me. I can hear